Good morning, welcome to the International Connection. Today is show number 44 in the radio series on mind control, and today we are bringing you part one of an interview with Gail Fisher-Taylor, a psychotherapist working with survivors of trauma. And we're going to talk about the nature of memory, and particularly traumatic memory. This will be the final interview in this radio series, Mind Control in Canada and the U.S. And to end off the series, we're going to have a panel discussion on February 22nd about ritual abuse and healing for survivors with Elise Murphy, Karen Stardancer, and Gail Fisher-Taylor. Then on March 1st, a panel about government-military mind control with Walter Boer. And now the interview with Gail Fisher-Taylor. I'm here speaking with Gail Fisher-Taylor, a psychotherapist who works with abuse survivors. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd like to start off with asking you, what is the current work that you're doing?
Well, I'm a psychotherapist, a consultant, and I also do training and education, particularly around trauma. And I work with people who basically want change in their lives, or they want to change something about their lives. So I work with a whole range of issues that people have, but I definitely specialize in the area of trauma. And that includes adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and of various kinds of sadistic abuse, and some who have been survivors of mind control.
Right. And throughout this radio series, I mean, the term ritual abuse has come up both within a cult setting and within a government mind control context. And I know with talking with you previously that you've had some trouble with that term, ritual abuse. How do you feel about how that's being used currently?
Okay, well, let me talk a little bit about the trouble I have with the term. Okay, I think it emphasizes the wrong thing. It emphasizes ritual. And what we're really talking about here is we're talking about criminal activity. We're talking about things like sexual abuse, like confinement, forms of mind control. We're talking about child pornography rings. We're talking about child prostitution rings, as well as adult pornography and prostitution rings. We're also talking about rituals that involve criminal activity, such as murder and torture. So I think what needs to be emphasized in the abuse is that it's criminal activity, often done by multi-perpetrators. They're often multi-victims in the crimes. It's cult activity, much of which is illegal. And I think that the term ritual abuse, emphasizing the belief system is part of it, but I think, and it's easy for the media and for other people to sensationalize that aspect of things. I think that sadistic cult abuse is a good term, but it's not totally comprehensive either. I think we have a problem with language here, mm-hmm. really defining what we're talking about and being really emphasizing the correct things. Also, in terms of this kind of abuse, just like to point out that it, what's involved in it is basically they're crimes against humanity. They're the kinds of crimes that we see in wars. They're the kinds of crimes that we know exist. And I think that when the ritual aspects are emphasized and sensationalized, as they are in the media, that it distances people from the reality of what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. And so you would more prefer to be more specific about what is actually involved in a particular case, whether it does involve child prostitution, pornography, or whatever kinds of criminal activities in terms of the context that abuse is taking place in?
Well, what I like to do is I like to try to talk about these kinds of abuse that a lot of people want to distance themselves from and want to disbelieve because they're so horrific. I think if we ground them, our discussions, in events and incidences that we know exist, that what we start doing is that we start making it more difficult for people just to concentrate on the sensationalist aspects of the crimes, basically. Mm. And what we need to do is we both need to relate this kind of abuse to what people know exists in our society, and we also need to relate it to what everyone can relate to. So I look at a lot of things on a continuum, mm-hmm. and this kind of abuse is very much on a continuum. It's not separate from all other kind of abuse. It's very much related to a lot of phenomena that many people have some sort of experience with, and we all have experience with by just watching TV and are involved. Yeah, reading a newspaper.
Right. Yeah, and I think people, in particular the media, tend to, when they hear that term ritual abuse, tend to automatically think it's a satanic ritual abuse and involves some kind of satanic cults, and which does exist out there, but a lot of people do have a hard time believing that goes on. And that really, as you mentioned, it takes away from the actual criminal activities that are happening, whether it's in the context of that kind of belief system or not.
Uh-huh. That's true. And I think there's another point here too, is that all repeated abuse is basically ritualized. And what I mean by that is that, for instance, if somebody is a serial killer, is they develop patterns of behavior so that when a serial killer murders a number of different people, the police are able to at least speculate that it's the same murderer because there are patterns within the way that murder is done. If somebody sexually abuses children, a pedophile, they're often ritualized aspects to the way that they sexually abuse children. And what it relates to probably is the traumatic reenactment of the actual perpetrator who's committing those crimes. In other words, what I'm saying here is that when somebody's been traumatized as a child and hasn't resolved that trauma, not everybody does this. There are lots of people who've been traumatized who don't reenact that on other people, but there are also a proportion of people who've been traumatized who then go on to commit the same crimes against other people later on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to talk about the process of processing experience into memory, because as you know, there's a big debate going on in public about so-called recovered memories, which are linked to traumatic experience. And I wonder if you could talk just a bit about how the human mind does process experience.
Okay, well, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about one way that we think, which is associatively. And what I mean by that is that if, let's say, we're walking along the street and it starts to snow and the snowflakes are really large flakes and we had an experience, let's say, a long time ago or maybe even recently, we might start to get feelings that we had in that experience. Let's say that we start remembering building a snow fort when we were a child, and that what happens is that all of those feelings, let's say it was a wonderful experience, all those feelings may start to come back just by the fact that we see these large snowflakes that remind us of an experience, a previous experience. We may start to get all kinds of sensory input from that previous time. We might start to, even though the air might be different in the present, we might remember what the air was like at that particular time. We might smell certain smells that aren't there in the present, but that were there at that particular time. We might hear sounds that aren't there in the present that were there at that particular time. And then what happens is that that we remember in all kinds of ways, and we encode our experience in all kinds of ways. And there's an implicit kind of remembering, which is basically sensory motor experiences. There's emotional experience that we remember, and then there's the explicit, which is more a narrative kind of remembering.
Telling a story about what happened.
That's right, mm-hmm. Sequential, and the explicit is actually a less reliable kind of remembering. We can get the details wrong. We can get the sequences wrong. Mm-hmm. The implicit, we might get confused because we have to interpret that explicitly, but that those body sensations, those sensory sensations, those emotions will relate in a... We know that they're from somewhere. We might get mixed up about what they relate to, but we know that they relate to a specific event or specific events in our lives.
Mm-hmm. So how does traumatic experience affect that process of association?
Well, it affects it in a number of ways. It depends upon the traumatic experience, and it depends upon the emotional significance of the traumatic experience, and it also depends upon whether it's repeated traumatic experience or a one-time traumatic experience. Clinically, what we start to see is that that trauma creates blocks, that it can keep a person in certain areas of his or her life sort of locked into certain belief systems, certain ways of interpreting things. What it can also do is that the associations are fragmented. In other words, what I mean is that if we remember in all of these different ways, and that experience is encoded, you know, in a sensory motor way and emotionally and in all of the senses, so that we hear certain sounds and we smell certain smells and taste certain tastes, that this is also in a non-traumatic experience, we would relate that to the narrative. We would have an idea about a wholeness of the event. What can happen in trauma, especially if it's repeated trauma or really profound trauma, is that this gets fragmented. And it's really a protective device, that if something terrible is happening that the individual has a hard time coping with, is that they're called opioids, which are chemicals inside our bodies that are like opium and create an effect that's similar to opium and are related to the shock that people go into, let's say, in an automobile accident or in other traumas. And they slow down the body, and it seems that with other kinds of neurochemicals in our nervous system, that what happens is that there's a fragmentation that occurs, so that we may have a recollection. There may be a lot of terror involved in a particular traumatic event, but we may block out completely what that terror is related to. So, for instance, I think that psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk gave a really excellent example about how it all works and how it can be different for different people. He was giving a talk and he was saying, "Now, if I suddenly exploded here," he said, "most of you in the audience would have what he calls a flashbulb memory. In other words, a very vivid memory, an enhanced memory for the rest of our lives of that event occurring." But he also had with him a colleague who knew him very well and who I imagine he was fairly close with. And he said, "Now, to my colleague, probably what would happen is that she would have a very vague memory, if she had any memory at all. And that would be because of the emotional significance of the event to her, that it would be very different to someone who knew him directly. It would be much more traumatic for her than it would be for those of us in the audience who didn't have an emotional relationship with him." And I think this is really significant in terms of children and adult survivors who as children have been abused by particularly a parent or some other person who has a strong relationship with them. So if a child is let's say sexually abused by a father or a mother, because we're finding more and more that there is abuse by women, and if if that child is dependent on that individual for survival, there's a real dilemma for that child, because she, I'll just say she, but it happens to he's lots too, she will need to remain attached to that individual for survival. And yet, the fact that this person who might be reading her bedtime stories is then sexually abusing her later on is extraordinarily confusing, and there's a tremendous amount of betrayal involved there. And so one thing that we see clinically is that these are the kinds of traumatic experiences that get dissociated quite frequently. And it's the element of betrayal that is often a very important factor in how much somebody will or will not remember about a particular, let's say, sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse by a parent.
So what is your understanding of the phenomena of dissociation and the different levels of dissociation that can happen? You brought up betrayal as a significant factor, and perhaps repeated extreme forms of trauma. But can you talk about what, in terms of the victim's point of view, what's going on there?
Okay, well, let me start first with dissociation, because again, I think very much on a continuum, and that everybody dissociates to a certain extent. I mean, if somebody's reading a book or playing an instrument, doing artwork, there's often a fair bit of dissociation involved in those activities. And what that is it's a form of hyperconcentration. And in that hyperconcentration, there's a splitting off and splitting away from other things that are going on, let's say, in the environment. What also happens, and everybody has ego states, which are basically parts of ourselves that that take on different roles and that feel different ways. So we all have child ego states that that are there from childhood and who have certain experiences, and that those experiences remain in that kind of age within us. So, for instance, when someone who, let's say, hasn't been traumatized at all, is in a particular situation, and let's say a particular ego state has had some injustice in his life, that what may happen is, in another situation in the present day, that child ego state may be basically triggered to come out and maybe reacts in a very strong way to an injustice in 1997. Now, what happens is, when somebody's been traumatized, is that the splits between the ego states become much more distinct. And that what happens is that they become, the dissociation in the way that somebody can split off and maybe not be as conscious of not just things in the external environment, but other kinds of things inside that person. I mean, we all have places in ourselves where we aren't aware of, we have times when we're not aware of, you know, why, when we say, oh, I'm not going to do that ever again, and then suddenly we find ourselves doing that right away. The way that I explain that is that basically, one ego state says, I'm never going to do it again, and out pops another one who says, oh, you aren't. I'm going to do it right now. And so it's a phenomenon that occurs in everybody.
But is this happening more on a subconscious level?
Yeah, it would be happening on a subconscious level or an unconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when somebody's traumatized is that these ego states become more and more distinctive and more operative as distinctive personalities, basically, or identities.
On a conscious level?
Well, what happens is that sometimes The person is totally not conscious that this is going on. I mean, the extreme of this would be when somebody has what used to be called multiple personality, which is now called a dissociative identity, and in the medical field, disorder. What happens is that that person may not be aware that there are these different identities that are coming out and acting in certain ways and dressing in certain ways, and there's a kind of sensation that somehow time has jumped ahead, you know, or that there's a confusion about what day it is. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that works in trauma is that someone will when somebody's traumatized, that there'll be a part, an ego state or an identity that will come forward and handle certain aspects of that trauma. And during one particular trauma, let's say that the person is being abused in some kind of way, there might even be a number of different identities that come out and handle different aspects of the abuse. And that it's, again, a very important protective mechanism when this is happening, so that the person is not having to handle everything and be totally overwhelmed. There's a fragmentation of experience in the different identities, so that one part, one identity might be handling, let's say that there's a demand to act like that identity is enjoying the sexual abuse. So there might be one identity who comes out and who actually learns to enjoy the sexual abuse. And then there might be another identity that's in a rage about the sexual abuse and holds the rage. And that those two identities don't have any co-consciousness with each other. They don't know that each other exists, and they don't know that the feelings that the other one has are there. And so it would work like that. There might be another part that feels very vulnerable and wants to cry during it. And that, again, there wouldn't be the co-consciousness with the other identity.
I guess the difference I was trying to get at with the normal ego states that we all have on a subconscious level don't ever really come out to the forefront in usually, whereas in people with, you know, the extreme end of that dissociative identity disorder can have different identities come out to the forefront where they take on the voice and the mannerisms of a child and so forth.
Yeah, well, I think in a way it's not so clear-cut as that. I mean, I think certainly with somebody who has dissociative identity, that there are very noticeable changes, and that with somebody who just has normal ego states that aren't so distinctive, if you start understanding ego states, you can start identifying that a particular ego state is there. They might not have exactly that childlike voice in an as extreme way, but what they may have is that they may have they may be saying things that make sense in a three-year-old context, you know, from a three-year-old's point of view, but don't make sense in that adult's point of view. And that when somebody is sounding that way, what's really happening is that there's another ego state there that's operating at a different stage of development. And when you start to understand these mechanisms, you start to see them, and they do come into the forefront. Mm-hmm. It's just they're more subtle. Right. Than with somebody who has dissociative identity.
So from what I'm hearing, in terms of just ego states in people that have not had a traumatic history or been severely traumatized, that there is a certain amount of communication going on there between the ego states. But what accounts for then the amnesia between identities, or the non-communication or non-awareness of the other identities within somebody that is dissociative?
Okay, well, I'm not sure I can answer what accounts for it. We can guess at it, and we can basically say that, I mean, one of the determining factors for the diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder, as it's called, is that somebody has to be amnestic. In other words, they have to have amnesia for certain blocks of time. And what, you know, from my experience and from those of us who are working in this field, I think, would agree with this, is that the amnesia, and particularly survivors would probably agree with this, that the amnesia really does protect in lots of ways. And so somehow it seems to be the survival mechanism and this protective mechanism that allows the fragmentation of experience to happen so that the individual isn't overwhelmed right in the midst of it, nor is the individual overwhelmed when these memories may be coming back, mm-hmm. or the ego states or the identities start getting together and start giving some of this experience, the knowledge of this experience.
So really the term disorder is really a misnomer. It seems to be a defense mechanism, a natural.
I think it is. I think a better word would be dynamic, because I think it is.
Coping strategy.
Yeah, it's a very dynamic coping strategy, mm-hmm. and I think that, sure, it can be maladaptive in adulthood and can cause problems, but that in a lot of ways what it does in the midst of the trauma is it can allow someone to survive who might not otherwise survive.
Mm-hmm. Now, with people that have been severely traumatized and are dissociative, I understand that there isn't that kind of move between implicit memory and explicit. There isn't somehow a processing of that experience fully that they can in their conscious state or their main persona, that they can't narratively tell what happened in an abusive situation before. And why is that? Why isn't that implicit memory processed?
Okay, well, there are basically some theories about this, and there's research that's backing some of these theories, or seems to be backing some of these theories. It seems that what is happening in trauma, when somebody's being traumatized, is that in the limbic system in our brain, that the amygdala, which basically gives emotional significance to things, or at least that's the theory, is very, very key in traumatic experience, and that implicit memory, that is, again, sensory, motor, and emotional, will be there, that the person may feel terror in this particular circumstance. But that what happens is that it seems that the hippocampus is bypassed, or at least that's the hypothesis, and that the hippocampus is what is needed to give order to things and to create a narrative.
And to create the associations?
Well, I mean, there are going to be associations without the hippocampus. Now, I'm oversimplifying here, but it seems that what happens in that overwhelming trauma is that that the people often do not remember the specific narrative. In other words, let's say that someone's mugged. Let's just go with something like this, as simple as this. What they may remember of that event is not the face. They may not be able to sort of give a narrative of, they may not have been looking at the face. They may be able to remember what the weapon looked like. Let's say that, you know, they were being mugged with a gun. They may be able to remember, they certainly will be able to remember the terror that they felt. They may not be able to remember all the events around it. That may be completely dissociated away. Or if it wasn't that terrifying, it seems to have to do with the adrenaline level. That when the adrenaline is at a certain level, that the memory will be, as Bessel van der Kolk talks about, a flashbulb memory. In other words, it will be remembered very vividly. But it's almost when the adrenaline level gets too high that what happens is that the memory will get vague, or there'll be that fragmentation involved where, you know, somebody knows that something terrifying happened. They may know something of the event, or they may know nothing of the event, particularly if it's repeated trauma, that it gets dissociated away.